My name is Larry Rasmussen, and all I want is a warm bed, a kind word, and unlimited power. That line, all I want is a warm bed, a kind word, and unlimited power, is not mine. It's from Ashley Brilliant. It comes on a postcard if you want to buy it. I want us to start this session on Jesus and power by singing the first and the third stanzas of a very familiar hymn. And that's what we'll do. The first stanza, however, says early in the morning, so you have to change that now to early in the evening. Okay, the rest of the words you can sing as it is. I won't play it through, you know it, so I'll just strike a chord and we'll go. Intention with love. What did you mean when you were saying that? Do you know any power that is harmonious with purity and love? God's what kind of power would that be?
God's
power. God's power. Okay, if this were catechism class, and I were asking you, and you gave the answer like and Chuck did, that would be correct, but you don't get by with that at Fulton. You'd maybe blush just a bit because you gave the right answer. God's power. Divine power. Holy power. But it begs the question, because the question is, exactly what kind of power is that? Anyway, how would you describe it? What kind of power would be harmonious with love and be pure? That is to say, would not be involved in moral compromise, or you wouldn't have impure means to good ends. I want to know what kind of, what God's kind of power is like. I mean, if it came into the room here and sat down in your lap, would you recognize it? How would you describe what was present?
Is that a rhetorical question or?
Yeah, no, that's not a rhetorical question. I would like to have people take a crack at it right now. How would you attempt to describe such power? I put on the board here a verse of Paul's from 1 Corinthians. Comes in a very famous passage in 1 Corinthians, and I just excerpted the one verse: the kingdom of God or the reign of God is not a matter of talk, but of power. Well, what kind of power is that? If you were a sociologist or a psychologist, or if you were simply describing your own experience of that power, how would you describe it? Let's just take a little time. And you'd say, tell me the answer to the question. This power is like, or I would characterize this power as follows. Yeah, Rudy.
As the created order of the universe.
This power is as the power of the created order of the universe. How would you further describe that?
As being everything that is embodied in creation and the sustaining of the creation.
Mm-hmm. As a kind of the energy of creation. Is that, would that be fair to say?
Yes, it is the energy.
Mm. How else would, I'm grateful for these, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time with these. So don't please understand this as passing them off or passing them by. In point of fact, the one that Rudy just brought up is the one we're going to spend some time with, the last of these five sessions on Jesus and power. What I want to do now is try to get our understandings of power out and relate them specifically now to God's kind of power. Yeah, in the back there, please.
Well, if you wanted a power that was easy to study, you'd want to study the power by which somebody gets something to do, something he wouldn't otherwise have done, and perhaps doesn't even want to do. That's the easiest kind to study.
Tell me that again.
It's the process by which A gets B to do something he didn't want to do.
Yeah, now that's the classic political scientist definition of power. When you get your will against the resistance of others. Yeah. Is that God's kind of power? Is that power perfect in power, love, and purity?
Okay,
would you describe that? I'm serious now. There's a whole lot in both the Old and New Testament, I think, which might say God's kind of power is coercive. And then you back off a little bit when you say, is it harmonious with love? And then we get into questions about how does God's judgment relate to God's mercy? But yours is a description almost lifted from both sociology and political science as a kind of generic definition of power as coercion. And I want to ask, do you see that as God's kind of power, as well as a kind of power that you can study by looking around at the way in which we interact with one another?
I don't want to eliminate it as God's kind of power. I don't think we understand God's kind of power well enough to say that it would do this but not that.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it's worth taking as the template for our understanding God's power.
Mm. That's tomorrow's session. Power is coercion. You're way ahead of me. See, I don't have this on the agenda for today. You're already into the rest of the week here. All right, I saw a hand over here. Hans? Yeah. Go ahead and then here.
Well, if we're trying to get at the one that I think we're working on today, the passage that comes to my mind is Romans 1:16. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God. There's a very different kind of power here, which empowers the weak, or he raises the dead, or the power that transforms the unacceptable into the accepted, the unlettered disciples into people of tremendous power, that is the power that wins others to enlightenment.
That's a lovely description, but you're putting it in the way, you're putting it in this way, the power that, and then you're telling me the results. It's very nice. Now, would you also give some synonyms for that power? Instead of describing its effects, can you also characterize it in other ways? This is power as, Rudy said energy, the gentleman back here said it's coercion. Is there something which describes that kind of power, or do we just leave it in terms of phrases?
It's a naming, like a naming power, like if you say to a person, you're adopting a child, you're my son, uh-huh. you're my daughter.
Uh-huh.
It's a relational uh-huh. naming mm. power. It would be one way mm-hmm. tackling it.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty hard to think about it other than thinking about it in New Testament terms.
Uh-huh.
And that's the direction I'm going. I don't know how theologically, Christological you want it.
Isn't the name for that agape?
Mm-hmm. Love?
Mm-hmm.
But a selfless love as opposed to uh-huh. eros.
Uh-huh.
Self-giving love?
There is certainly the experience of that kind of power in the biblical materials, and we're going to look at Jesus and the people around Jesus who testify to that. I'm interested in this week together in talking both about what we experience as power in our own lives and the way in which we describe it, very commonplace experiences of power, things that we really can describe in ways that an observer might relate to. And I'm interested in talking about the power that we see in Jesus and in the movement around Jesus, and then setting up a conversation between those two. So we can go both ways with this description now. I started out with a hymn and asking about God's kind of power, but don't shirk from describing that as one's own experience in the present, as well as what one sees reflected in the biblical accounts. Yeah.
I see God's power as a healing and transforming power.
Healing and transforming. Some of what you were saying, Hans, is this transforming, the transformative aspect. Healing, very prominent, of course, in biblical accounts. Now, with healing, it sounds like a different kind of power from coercion.
But it isn't necessarily. If you want to think about the healing that's caused by casting out evil demons, that was never an action that was very popular with demons.
No, you're right. Yeah, that's right. Pretty coercive from that point of view. Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking more of the healing of the body, which is, of course, overcoming resistance of whatever it is that's attacking the body.
I was just going to say, for me personally, it's the power that is available when there is no human power for me to solve things, to cope with things. And I know that power is there, so it's an available power above man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of extraordinary quality about it. Yeah,
I think about it the way that Joanne is talking. Is that your name?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
is talking about it as surrender.
Power as surrender. You're talking. Okay.
And I think about watching my child be born, and being like, trying to make it happen by counting the beeps and the breaths, and that's the human coping way, and then eventually just going, okay, letting go. and feeling more powerful in some senses after that, or being on the edge of a cliff and not knowing how to get down and having to figure out how to do that and thinking I can figure it out and then realizing I just have to let go and some of the power guide me now. So that kind of surrender.
Gravity is a suggestion.
And I sat down and just slipped. But it's still letting go. It's that letting go or surrender.
Yeah. One of the paradoxes of power is that we think of power oftentimes in terms of control, and we often experience power in terms of being vulnerable to that which happens to us. Yeah.
So I don't know if the word change and transform are exactly synonymous, but the power that I've observed is the power of people to change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably been the most, for me, myself, what I would call God acting in my life is for change.
Mm-hmm. I'll just offer a generic definition of power. Now, it's not an attempt to describe God's kind of power specifically, but since power is the subject for the week, it's probably helpful anyway to have a definition of power. And a common generic definition of power is simply the ability or the capacity to conserve, change, or endure a state of affairs. And that doesn't say everything, but it does say some things. You're referring to one of them, you're referring it to your experience of it in terms of God's power, but power is the capacity to change a state of affairs. Interestingly enough, though, power is also the capacity to conserve a state of affairs. Things don't stay the same without power. Rudy brought up the power of creation. Much of that is a sustaining kind of power. And I think from especially the experience not only of peoples who have been oppressed, but all of us, whether we know an oppression or not, whether it's in the, perhaps it's by knowing illness or sickness or something, but we've been in circumstances we couldn't change. And someone else was conserving, and we didn't have much interest in that being conserved, but that we found the power to endure that situation. That's a real power. Even when you cannot conserve or change, there is a power in the power to endure. So I think it is helpful enough, helpful to see power in terms of sustaining or conserving. Those aren't exactly the same. Changing, but also enduring. Well, I don't know if we've got quite yet the answer to what kind of power is this that's perfect in power, love, and purity. Don't be discouraged if you don't quite have that yet. Paul Tillich said the hardest book that he ever wrote was a little one called Love, Power, and Justice, because he assumed that somehow they all belonged together and that they were not opposed to one another. So if you've haven't got it quite right yet in your own mind about how love, power, and justice, and purity dwell harmoniously together, you're in good company. What I want to do now is kind of describe the landscape for the week. And today's session is to explore together a little bit of that landscape, but after today, then I want us to go to kinds of power and talk about them. Tomorrow will be power as coercion, and I've forgotten the exact titles. One day we're going to talk about power as nurture, I don't exactly have the words for this, partly because I'm struggling with this topic very much myself, and what I want to come out of the week is some more precision about power and our experience of power. But power as nurture is going to be a session. One session on power, I'm calling it power as ideology. What I really mean is that all of us are socialized to see the world in a particular way and act upon, act in it, in keeping with the way in which we see things. That's an extraordinary power, the power to frame a person's perception of things. And I want to talk about that power. And then I want to talk about power as energy, or if, and I need some help from the scientists here, power as elemental force in creation itself. And how that's very much a part of our lives, in the marrow of our bones, literally. Then I want us to spend time each day relating those kinds of power as we experience them, as we observe them as well, to some of the materials in Jesus and the Jesus movement. Because I think that we see throughout the biblical accounts, and I'm focusing especially on the Gospels, these kinds of power made manifest, and it's very interesting to then set up a conversation between our experience and observations of power and what we see happening in those biblical accounts. I put on the board up here two books that are in the bookstore that relate to what we're doing. They don't talk straightforwardly about power. One of the reasons I'm very interested in this subject is because I can't go pick up a book entitled Jesus and Power. I think there's lots of connections, but not too many people have put them together. So I can't commend to you lots of good reading. It hasn't been written. But the book by Marcus Borg called Jesus, A New Vision is a nice reporting of current biblical scholarship about Jesus. And it's just a quick way to find out what the biblical scholars are saying about this rather enigmatic and rather compelling figure who is experienced as extraordinarily powerful by many around him. So this is just a report by the biblical scholars of who they see this one to be, and the movement that he headed. Then a very, very different book is the one by Ryan Eisler, The Chalice and the Blade, which is a kind of synthesis of a good bit of work done by feminist writers, and I personally think the feminists are saying more to us now about the character of power than most anyone writing. And Ryan Eisler has gathered some of that up. She works as a historian and an anthropologist, and what rather intrigues me is that her middle chapters are about Jesus, even though she is, to my knowledge, not a Christian, and certainly is not coming at the whole subject as one trying to vindicate a religious point of view. She just finds in Jesus a particular paradigm of power that represents what she thinks is the kind of power the world needs to know more about and act upon. So I found that quite intriguing. And I'm too modest to put one of my own books up there, but I'm not too modest to mention. There is in the bookstore a book called Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Significance for North Americans, and chapter 7 in there is entitled Divine Presence and Human Power. And I won't be sharing the Bonhoeffer materials this week, but you may be interested in that chapter in conjunction with this week. So I'm going to spend a few minutes now. Let's see, what do we have? If we start at 5:05, do we finish at 5:06?
6:05.
6:05, we have a full hour. All right. I want to share a few things now about my motivation for these topics with you, and then I want us to come back to pick up the discussion together, a bit in the way in which we began, but maybe a little more focused kind of subject. There are then these two focal points, our experience of power and observations about power, and then power as we see it manifest in Jesus and the Jesus movement. And I want, I'm interested in doing this because I simply want to understand the recurring testimony that Jesus was and Jesus is a power in people's lives. It has struck me since taking up this topic in some teaching that our liturgy, our biblical materials, the lessons that we read on Sunday, the prayers that we pray, all contain over and over again the P word. It's there all over the place. And yet, when you talk with Christians about power, they shy from talking about it, except they keep talking about it all the time. So there must be some different kinds of power that they're talking about. They must not like some kinds, but do like other kinds, or else they're just not paying attention to what they're saying. They don't know whether it's verse 4 or verse 3, and they haven't sort of picked up on the language. Anyway, Christians have, from the very beginning, said that Jesus is a power in their lives, and I simply want to try and understand what they have meant by that. I don't want to preach it. I don't want to witness to it as a matter of personal piety. I'd like to hear other folks do that. I don't want to sing it as a baritone solo. People have done that too. I just want to understand it. I want to understand it in a way that a sociologist or a psychologist or a political scientist or a historian or John and Jane Doe would understand it when they heard someone tell about it. That kind of description of power is what I'm motivated to explore with you. At the most superficial level, my question is, why has Time magazine, which usually cannot be accused of an unquenchable thirst for deep theology, put Jesus on the cover 16 times in Time magazine's 65 years? I mean, every politician ought to know that and weep. 16 times in 65 years. Why? But at a deeper level, my question is the power met in Jesus the very power even of God? And if so, what is that kind of power? And does that have anything to do with getting on the cover of Time magazine so many times? What precisely is the power ascribed to God? And can it be described in non-religious ways, as well as through religion, the testimony of those who have experienced it? That's what I'm interested in. Well, whether or not we can say what kind of power God's power is, and whether Jesus is a parable of God's power, I want to call two very conspicuous facts to your attention. One is that in both testaments, the Older Testament and the Newer Testament, power is the attribute of God. If you ask people of the biblical communities what they think of when they think of God, they always think of power. The power to create. That's an awesome power, and no one else has it. Only God has that kind of power. The power to destroy, the power to save, the power to plant and pluck up, the power to change, transform, the power to cast down, the power to redeem, the power to renew. That attribute of God is the leading attribute of God, I think. And in fact, not only in the Jewish and Christian communities, but in all of the rituals and records of people, it is the case that divinity is associated with nothing so much as power. Across the board, that's the association with divinity, as power. And I think one might even understand religion as a human phenomenon, as the effort of human beings to channel the sacred as an awesome power. Maybe what religion is up to and about. The very idea of the holy, we sing holy, holy, holy. The very idea of the holy is as a mysterium tremendum. Nothing quite universally defines God as does as unsurpassed power. I think that's probably what we mean by God. Unsurpassed power. So I just want to know what that is. What is unsurpassed power? What does it look like? What does it feel like? How would you describe it? All right. It's certainly the case that that Jesus regards his God as unsurpassed power and as the one who offers an unsurpassed power for life. Indeed, I love Monica Hellwig's line in her book called Jesus, the Compassion of God. In the book she writes, Jesus lives as though God reigns and none else has power over him. I think that's the key to Jesus' power. Jesus lives as though God reigns and none else has power over him. Jesus certainly sees God as unsurpassed power and as offering unsurpassed power for life. But to say that Jesus lives as though God reigns and none else has power over him isn't yet an understanding of that power. It doesn't yet name it. And that's what I would like us to do. Okay, one more thing, and then we want to spend some time talking together. If the first fact is that divinity is always associated with power, the second fact is that in the New Testament, people invariably associate Jesus and power. Whether or not they associate Jesus with divinity, it'll come as a bit of a surprise to some of you, because we live on the other side of the founding of the churches and of the creeds, the great creeds, on the other side of Easter. But there are very few claims in the New Testament that Jesus is God. There are claims that Jesus is Christ, Jesus is the Messiah, Jesus is the chosen one, Jesus is the Son of God, but that Jesus is God, you won't find there. A couple of claims. One of them that I've always delighted in is that the fact that the person that we call Doubting Thomas is the one who says, "My Lord and my God." He's not, he's got a bad press, Thomas here. He's one of the few in the New Testament who called Jesus God. But that's an aside. Whether or not Jesus is associated with divinity, Jesus is associated with power. And whether or not whether or not you like Jesus, that is the people then, liked Jesus or not, he was associated with power. That is to say, he was associated with power both by those who joined his band and by those who opposed him.
But excuse me for interrupting, but you mean that he's not called God in the synoptics? Because in John, it's all over the place.
Well, John is, when I meant very few, it's John.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's the first chapter of John. It's the opening chapter of John. And you have it in the Gospel of John, and you have it in Hebrew. I suppose that's lots, but most people are surprised to find there are so few claims about Jesus' divinity. Yeah. Those who experience, those who follow this Nazarene experience power in him, as do those who would be rid of him. The Gospels are riddled with comments that go like this. Jesus, with the power of the Spirit in him, returned to Galilee. You'll enjoy the Marcus Borg book on the relating of Jesus to the world of the Spirit. But just note, the next time you read your New Testament through from beginning to end, or at least the Gospels, how often it says, "And Jesus, in the power of the Spirit, went about doing such and such." When Jesus had finished these parables, he left the district. And coming to his hometown, he taught the people in their synagogue in such a way that they were astonished and said, "Where did this man get this wisdom and these miraculous powers? This is the carpenter's son, surely. Is not his mother the one called Mary, and his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Jude? His sisters, too, are they not all here with us? So where did this man get this power?" From Matthew 13. He taught in the temple every day. The chief priests and the scribes, with the support of the leading citizens, tried to do away with him. But they did not see how they could carry this out, because the people as a whole hung on his words. Luke 19. There are the case of several plots against Jesus. But they worried because he had too much power. That is, the people hung on him. Even the shattering disappointment of Bad Friday and the rapid dispersal of the disciples is only understandable in view of their expectation that Jesus had or had promised extraordinary power. You only understand their actions in light of the fact that they thought something absolutely awesome was going to transpire in going to Jerusalem. It was power expectations. Now, what kind of power? And whether they got it right is another question. And I'm just talking about the association of power with Jesus. And I only add that the follow-up surprise, the resurrection, has always been seen as the most extraordinary power of all, namely the power of life over death. Jesus is almost always associated with power by his friends, by his numerous opponents, by those willing to entertain that he might be the anointed one of God, and by those who ridicule that claim and who find it blasphemous. All of them agree on one thing. We're dealing with power here. Even death on a cross the most humiliating kind of death of all. It was a form of capital punishment which was reserved for traitors and rebels and blasphemers that looks, for all the world, like abject powerlessness, like utter weakness. But remember that Jesus is crucified precisely because he is powerful, or he's perceived as such, which is much the same thing. And remember also that some heard in the deadly silence at the cross the seismic whisper of the power of none other than God. And it's Paul, of course, who makes much of the contention that the principalities and the powers, the elemental forces of the universe, are themselves disarmed by a crucified Christ. There's a power at work there. That's the conviction against other powers. And that's all I'm trying to do at this point, is make a simple kind of connection of the association of Jesus and power, and then move into an effort to describe that kind of power. Well, the beat goes on. I'll mention one more thing here. The people of the Jesus movement, the early church, almost never talk of themselves as powerless, except sometimes to describe the condition that pertained before they got religion, before they were bitten by Jesus. They'll sometimes talk about that as powerlessness. Now, the thing that's striking there is that so many of these folks came from the ranks of the socially marginalized. Isn't that curious? That people who are regarded as relatively powerless, and who oftentimes think of themselves as precisely that, in these materials never talk about themselves as powerless. Now, not all of them came from those ranks, but most of them did. I say not all of them, because one of the striking facts about the Jesus movement and the early church is the social diversity there and the forging of community on the part of people who were normally at odds with one another. This is a kind of distinguishing mark. I won't call it unique, but a kind of distinguishing mark of people in the Jesus movement. Is Jews and Gentiles, bond and free, rich and poor, men and women, Roman soldiers and citizens in an occupied land, tax collectors and those kinds of citizens, find themselves in the same community when they are the social groups at enmity with one another. And one thing that we want to ask about, what kind of power makes for that kind of community? How do you get groups in society which are in conflict with one another as members of a community together? Is that the kind of power that you see in Jesus? Can you describe that kind of power sociologically? What we have is the testimony by these people that they feel themselves caught up in an extraordinary power. They feel themselves empowered. That's why I think Paul's sociology is at least as interesting as his theology sometimes. And I'm just reading now from 1 Corinthians, the same place where this comes from, only a little bit earlier. Paul says to the folks in Corinth, take yourselves, for instance. At the time you were called, how many of you were wise in the ordinary sense of the word? How many were influential people? or came from noble families. No, it was to shame the wise that God chose what is weak by human reckoning. Those whom the world thinks common and contemptible are the ones that God has chosen. Those who are nothing at all, to show up those who are everything. We, I think, often think of that pedestrian band of early house church goers as relatively powerless people. And all I'm saying is that those folks themselves, like Jesus, thought they had hold of a power against which the very gates of hell could not prevail. Not Caesar, nor an earlier version, not the Pharaoh, nor all of the gods roaming about in the classical culture could enslave those folks. They felt themselves empowered and really transcendently free. And I just think that's really quite extraordinary, given their lot in life, given the strata that they occupy, given their kinds of conditions. And I just want to know, what kind of power is it that they experience? Can it be named? How would you describe that kind of power? How does that kind of power work? What happens to individuals? What happens to groups? What goes on when that happens? How do they describe it? If you came by it or it has happened to you, how do you describe it? Let's do that for the remaining time. I realize it's not much time. Let's take a few minutes and make some suggestions, which we'll pick up then in the sessions the rest of the week. If we're back in catechism class and the answer was that's God's kind of power, and we didn't accept that as saying enough, and we went on to say something like this: now, class, please finish the following sentence. I would describe the power seen in Jesus like this. Its power as dot, dot, dot.
Turning a person's life around 180 degrees.
Okay. Can you say something about that kind of power?
Yeah. The best word I can think of is surrender, or willingness to surrender. Willingness to surrender one's own will, one's own ego, one's own whole being to a complete trust act where you, I don't want to make copy of it. You surrender to yourself to this power.
Uh-huh. What is this power that you're surrendering to? I hear you in describing your participation in that. Now, how would you describe that power that turns you around? And many people
grace.
Would put it that grace. How we frequently say this, and I'm glad we do. I think it's right. We say grace as power and pardon, something like that. What is grace as power?
It is something that happens inside of a person. What is that power, though?
Can I take a stab at it?
Sure.
It's sort of interesting since I'm Jewish, and so grace is one of the things that I differentiate myself around, but I think used the term surrender earlier also.
Yes, yes.
And for me, it's the issue of freedom from fear. Mm-hmm. And that's my understanding of what people talk about. It's freedom from fear at a very core level. I just happen to believe that's something you have to continually rework, rather than, you know, having it something that's a state of existence.
Does freedom from fear, is that part of
It.
The Trust Act that you were talking about? That
I had an experience like this. I can have a place and a date even where a miracle happened to me, and it's been with me ever since. I lived in fear and dread for 25 years, and that was the end of it then.
That's real power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not that I don't get scared at times, or that fear doesn't, threaten to crop its ugly head up, and it does at times, but I was given a power where I can also, by surrendering, eliminate that fear once again. Mm. But
part of what you're talking about, it constantly.
Right.
This is helpful. Let's keep going here. How power has either continue this or something else.
Well, very much along those lines. I would name that as unconditional experience of unconditional love, of total acceptance.
Uh-huh.
Or to put it in other terms, in terms of the hymn, you know, just as I am type of thing. Where, it's very difficult to define. You describe it and seek for words to explain that. It's not really explicable.
No, although people do insist upon talking about it. They say, maybe
it's true.
I just can't describe it, and then they go on to tell you their experience. Yeah. So they insist upon trying to.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in what they say. Unconditional love. Yeah, let's talk about this. How do you describe love, unconditional or otherwise, as a power? How does it work?
Well, I think it's very it's a freeing power.
Mm-hmm.
Because to be unconditionally loved is, I think, to have that freedom, or to experience that freedom from fear, or to use Lutheran categories, freedom from sin, death, and the power of the devil. The fear of.
Uh-huh.
And not having that as being the dominant determining factor of my life, but that I feel confident, assured in the, if you will, in the hands of God, which is a trust thing again. But that's...
Now, this is interesting. Now, how would you describe the power of the devil? That's what we're being freed from. What precisely is the power in the power of the devil? When you think of our baptismal vows, if you renounce the devil and all his works and all his ways, I said divinity is always associated with power.
Yeah.
So is the demonic, always associated with power. What is that kind of power?
It's control instead of freedom.
Over here, fear. In bondage to fear, control instead of freedom.
I would say it's a self-acceptance that allows power to come from within, rather than a control that is restricting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think both of the issues turn on need, human need, emotional need, and I see that as the empowering from God is to my need, and the power of the devil, or Satan, the demonic, is also for need. And the need to control, the need to love, the need to be loved, or whatever. But I think both of those hinge on this, on the need of the humans, of myself.
In general terms, or are you talking about a specific?
I'm talking both generally and specifically. reason that I am empowered by God is because God meets my needs. The reason that I look on God as a power is because God meets my needs. That's, to me, it's as basic as that.
Chuck?
I don't want to try to define God's power, but I'd like to throw out what I consider a trait of God's power, and that would be that God's power doesn't require conventional power to sustain. Most power plays require additional power to sustain them, a conventional power, a corporate power or something like that. Mm-hmm. But that's definitely lacking in God's power.
But there was there was some sort of, there must have been some sense, some empowering sense of almost a marriage between these insignificant little bands of Jewish and Gentile Jesus followers, some sense of marriage with prophetic righteousness that in the face of the empire, including the culture, they went about this countercultural business as if they were free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, their testimony is that they are transcendently free.
This power most often happens in the face of despair. When peoples or people are driven to their knees, their blinders are removed and they see like as if they were blind before.
Yeah.
You know, one thinks one worships the real God, and one's blinders might be taken off and one can see why. Oh no, I was worshiping some other idol, but now I see who the real God is. It's something like that. But it often takes place in moments of despair.
Although, yeah, Dan, you're on your way out there. That's certainly the case, but it seems to me that some of the folks that Dan were talking about are not. Is it the case that their experience is one of despair?
Like the first Christian?
Yeah, like.
Well, weren't they persecuted something horribly?
Well, second, third century, yeah, but not in following Jesus.
But it seems to me Jesus' followers were always wanted people. He was always having pity on the crowds, and they were like a hungry, thirsty, hurting people, it seemed like, the people who wanted to listen to him, who were willing. They weren't the satisfied, I'm so happy in this world type.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I may be wrong. That's all I perceive.
No, I was asking about despair. That isn't precisely what I would say about despair, but you characterize them in a...
Well, I think despair has different levels.
Yeah.
You know, to some people it doesn't mean being wiped out of, you know, it doesn't mean you have to lose your home and your job and your kids and your everything, you know, you might, some people do lose it all. Yeah. Some people lose half and some don't lose really much at all, but there's somewhat of a despair inside who you, where you're going, what direction your life is taking, I think, when you may come face to face with the spiritual experience, so to speak.
Yeah. One thing that I don't know how much time we have to explore these things. One thing that I would like to do in the process of this study of Jesus and power is just to talk about the different sorts of conditions that people find themselves in when they do experience what they name as the power of God. I think you would find quite a variety.
Yes.
Sometimes it might be a kind of lives of quiet desperation.
Yes.
Sometimes it might be a crisis. Other times it may not be a kind of crisis. just to talk about that, because that relates to the power dynamics. Now, Chuck, I want to come back to your remark, and because I don't think that was picked up here. So say again what you said before. God's
well,
kind of power.
Corporate power, what we usually think of as power, you need more power to sustain that power.
Yeah.
But God's power is there, and you don't need corporate type power to sustain it. That's a trait. It's not.
Right.
I think if we can describe the traits of God's power, we can get closer to a definition of God's power.
What you say interests me because of one of the oldest understandings of God that the Orthodox community, Greek, Russian, Orthodox community has nurtured these two millennia, where they understand God as the uncreated energy of the universe. So that we talk about power in terms of the created energy of the universe, and you can pass it on in different kinds of forms, but their distinction of God from the rest of creation is that God is the uncreated energy of the universe. A little different way of saying something of the same sort of thing.
So, but we're talking here about God does not need to have God's power reinforced or from any other source. We're not talking about our sense of God-empoweredness, right? Because we do need that.
Yeah. We're getting into deep theology here, because that's a question of the relationship of God's power and our power, and whether there's reciprocity there, and whether God does, in fact, in a sense, live from.
Doesn't that get into the question of perfect in power, then, when we're talking
perfect
about God's
in
power? As in limitless, endless, having no need.
Do we mean omnipotence, or what do we mean by omnipotence? Here. What's the relationship? Yeah, or by perfection. Okay.
I think we see power in action right here.